Well, hi, everybody. I had a little trouble getting to my own conference line. Well, we are poised for our final seminar, and we're going to add some time at the end for discussion. But first, things that you'd like to talk about, questions, observations, anything that you'd like to add or ask at the beginning.
Hi, Dave. This is Eric. I'm good.
Hey, welcome. Go ahead. Thanks. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Dan. No. Yep, we're good.
Okay, I'm gonna ask each of you to reflect on what was for you the most important thing that you're taking away from this seminar series at the end, and of course, if there are any questions you still have about mentor coaching clients around money issues or incorporating some of these concepts. So anything anyone would like to add or ask now at this point? Or any clarifications from any of the previous seminars?
Well, Dave, this is Ron. How are you?
Ron, go ahead. Hey, how are you doing?
Just one question to either consider now or at the end, but just, you know, when you can be coaching, if there is a couple that has different money stories, how do you typically handle that or approach that? That would be something very interesting, I think, to address.
I think that's a really excellent question. Consider the way that each couple approaches money and what their money story is. Let's say, for example, that one partner is wired to see money as security, and the other partner is wired to see money as freedom. So they're going to be going in opposite directions. To be able to have freedom and spend money brings pleasure to one. Being able to save money and have security brings it to the other. So to look at some of the fundamental needs and ideals of each partner, as well as what money means to each, can be a beginning of creating a foundation of collaboration to co-create a new story that's not either story alone or capitulating one to the other, but the principle, when you work with coaching a client, when you coach a couple, you have one client. That's the relationship. You don't have two clients. So I think it's important to treat that partnership as your client. The relationship is your client, so that you don't meet privately with one or the other or keep any secrets, or your client is the relationship, the couple, just as when you do group coaching, your client is the group. So you're going to facilitate finding as much as you can about each of their individual stories and how they can begin to co-create and contribute to a unified story that will not be primarily one or the other, but something new and different for both. So it's a collaboration, a negotiation, and something I think where a coach can really offer something exquisitely valuable, because just because they have disagreements or different ideas or different meanings of money, nothing about that says they need therapy in terms of going back and understanding dynamics and looking at all the past issues. No, they need the collaboration to begin in the present moment, understanding each of their stories, looking at the choice architecture of how they make decisions together going forward. Now, Ron, does that begin to address what you had in mind, or are there other aspects that that you want to add to the hopper here?
No, and that addresses it well. I think you've done couples work before, but it sounded to me like the one person is your client, and you approach things through that individual's story, and that person could or could not be the vehicle to co-create a new story with their partner, but in that case, that has to be worked through that individual. Is that correct?
I think the answer to that is no.
No.
You don't have two clients. You don't even have a client by proxy when you're working with one individual. When you're working with one individual, a basic foundational understanding is that that person can't determine how someone else responds. And if they assume that they need to or want to or should be able to determine how someone else responds, they're going to be very frustrated and very ineffective. So that may be one of the first things to look at, because someone who's your client can only deal with the decisions they make, and if they expect someone else to respond as if they were an extension of their interest or desire, they're going to absolutely ensure frustration. So you have one client, and that client is the person you're talking to. If it's a couple, then that client is the couple. But it's not
okay.
One client,
yeah,
trying to have sway or influence on another by collaborating with you.
And I understand
that. Because it won't work, basically.
I understand that. And I maybe didn't say that clearly, because that's what I was saying. You've got the one client, but to any degree that they have an action item or want to take steps for their own story, and it's not really trying to sway the other, but I think I get it, and it's clear. I don't want to belabor it, but this has been very helpful.
Yeah, Stephen Covey talked about this in terms of the circle of influence and the circle of concern. The circle of concern are all the things that you have concern about but have absolutely no way to determine or have influence about what they do. And that usually is everything beyond your skin. The circle of influence is everything that you can determine yourself, and that usually ends at the level of your skin. So a real important aspect when you're working with someone who will think, well, you know, if my partner would just do this, or if my boss would just respond in this way, or if I could just get my kids, to recognize that they can only determine what they do and come to accept that and let go of everything they can't determine, they'll be considerably more effective, considerably happier, and can deploy their resources and their energy to what they can be effective in doing. And that's their story. And that will come up for, and probably has for every one of you, for many, many clients, because that's something that is an important distinction. And to be able to let go of what someone can't determine, even though it may be disappointing or may not be an optimal resolution or solution, but to then put energy into what they can determine, significantly more effective. So it's a good point in coaching, and it's a good point in working with couples, both. So, yeah, thanks very much, Ron. Any other comments, questions, or thoughts before we move into the material? Okay, well, I'll put us on lecture mode, and we'll rejoin the discussion in just a bit. Okay, we're going to talk about the final two steps in this seminar. Step six is to author new experiences, to actually create a new story. And remember, we trust our stories. They're our reality. And it's not that these are our stories. It's just the way things are. And remember that for clients, as we've talked before. When we talk in terms of training and strategies of coaching, and we're talking about money stories, wellness stories, any other stories, for the client, it's not a story. It's just the way things are. This is our metaphor, our way of looking at and understanding the components, the algorithms that go into creating a story in order to listen to how to understand, how to deconstruct, and help a client to create a revised and better story or a new story. So our stories are our reality. When our stories and our behaviors don't fit, we experience disharmony. So we have to change one or the other to restore harmony. Sometimes we revise our stories. Sometimes we just change even the way we see reality. And we've considered if your story doesn't allow you to do certain things. If your story is that you're a procrastinator, it may disallow you from finishing early or even on time. If your story says you don't do technology well, you'll live out this assumption. So let's look just briefly at the dynamics of change in this step of authoring new experiences. First, the idea of change may create excitement. Then, as it's on the cusp of action, trepidation or anxiety. Then, expansion, and then ultimately, mastery. Now, there are a couple of additional, and that's highly compressed, as you know. Two additional aspects of experiencing change can seem paradoxical. Every step forward means relinquishing a past position. Someone must mourn. They must say goodbye, both practically and emotionally, to a familiar and maybe well-practiced old story. This is a process. It's a developmental step. It's not something you can just say and make it so or recognize it and change it. It's like saying goodbye to an old friend to give up a habit or a pattern of behavior or hope that by getting the old story just right or doing it better, it'll make it work. No matter how maladaptive, the old story still has to be mourned. And secondly, the more subtle aspect in learning something new and creating change is an injury to self-esteem, because this carefully crafted old story that's become the default mode so that its algorithms are an anatomical reality in the brain, this carefully crafted old story have aspects of identity attached, and then suddenly it's replaced by something better. So this is a jolt to someone's identity. Now, we're going to spend all of the last step, the P in the roadmap, on programming new identity. So we're going to come back to that. So I see some components of change in this dynamic that we're talking about of change and transition. Now, these are not headlines. You're not going to see things that you can label necessarily, but these are just to think about as kind of conceptual markers, a way that we listen to and monitor change. The myth that there's a perfect choice. The illusion that the perfect choice is going to solve all problems. Ultimately, then, the disappointment that nothing's perfect. There isn't even an ultimate arbiter of fairness as an adult. The development, the recognition that nobody's going to take care of it for you. The growth to take the next best action. And the consolidation, the happy, sad experience resulting. Happy about the autonomy of moving ahead, the effectiveness and mastery, and the effectiveness of not constructing an obstacle, and sad about mourning the old story. I first recognized this in dealing. I had one of the first two or three major eating disorder treatment programs in the country back in my day as a shrink, and there wasn't much known in those days about eating disorders. There were hundreds of my patients who actually thought they had discovered bulimia. They were surprised to learn that other people did it too. Every one of these young women mostly saw the bulimia when she grew beyond it and found other ways of adaptation, found that it was like grieving an old friend because it was a habit. It was like an old friend because it was there when no one else was. It was painful, it was limiting, but yet it was always there. And that reliability, that consistency was something that had to be mourned. So the bulimia itself had to be mourned like an old friend. Now, let's look at some, in revising this story, let's look at some of the assumptions and biases. You'll see in the workbook, I think there are 25 listed. I want to just highlight some just to give you an idea of some of the more common ones in each of the four categories. The ABCs are what I'm terming them. This is a way of organizing the most common financial mistakes in order to get a level of understanding. The compromised money behaviors and financial decisions I'm going to illustrate fall into one of four categories of the ABCs: affect or feeling, behavior, cognitive, or social biases. So, these are in the workbook along with their remedies. I want to highlight the most common ones. An example of an affect bias, an emotional bias, is nostalgia bias. We feel more nostalgic at particularly challenging and difficult times because nostalgia remembers things not as they were, but as we wish them to be. Airbrushed memories backlit by idealization. Nostalgia recalls the ideal rather than the real. For example, has anyone gotten worse in high school and college sports as the years go on, or less popular in memory replays? I am really close to being All-State in basketball twice in one season, probably by next year. And that was the season we were undefeated, I think. Now, marketing taps into nostalgic experiences. It's easier and faster to associate with idealized memories than to create new product identification. The nostalgic trigger then is coupled with new information, and the coupling uses nostalgia to influence choice. Arnold Palmer and that old tractor, remember that ad? Two classics preserved by one particular motor oil. Another, invincibility bias. The seemingly inextinguishable sense of immortality we all had when we were young, peaking in adolescence. There still may be whispers of that in adulthood. 19% of the population believe they're in the upper 1% of income. 90% of all drivers believe they're above average. 75% believe they're healthier than average. And just remember the tech rally investors in the late 1990s before the market crash, or in 2008 with the banking crisis. A couple of behavior biases now. We're going in the ABC order. One is transference fallacy. In psychoanalysis, the tendency to redirect feelings from a past context to a current one is a kind of transference. It simply means that we're using old software that was tailor-made for an earlier situation to read a current situation. An example, Digital Equipment Corporation posted a 13% decline, and then Hewlett-Packard collapsed half its value that same day. Totally unrelated, nothing was related except in the mind of investors. They were both digital companies specializing in computers at that time. Another, spending justification, creating a just cause to spend. Someone takes money from retirement savings to spend with a justification of an immediate need being greater than the abstract future need of repayment, of retirement, rather. So the coaching question is, how will you repay it? And the individual may have already internally bargained to say, well, I'm going to pay it with the next paycheck or next month, or it may be vaguely dismissed with a vow to return the money at some point. Neither is a plan. I'm going to ask you guys, and I want you to think about this. We're talking about mistakes, biases, and that sort of thing. I'm going to ask you in our discussion, because I want to hear your response, what's the most common money mistake that we make? And think about that. Here's another. Status quo bias. The resistance to leaving a comfort zone. It's another name for inertia. The default option is for us to stay in our comfort zone. Here's an example. Marketers know that when they give a first free 3-month trial, and then you have to unsubscribe in order to not be charged beginning the 4th month, there's an inclination to stay with the familiar, the status quo, and not cancel. Between 75 and 80% of initial free describers stick with their default choices, even when they're costly or compromised. 64% who do that with a subscription do not read the subscription that they continue paying for. We even tend to avoid information that causes distress. For example, to determine a financial number that would create comfort in retirement and set it as a goal. We can set the program, the status quo, to make good choices the default pattern. An example, the automatic enrollment savings program for retirement. Companies that offer an initial opt-in get about 20% enrollment. If it's automatic, it's 100%, and then it tails off to about 90%. Or if you do it yourself, you don't have to have anyone else be the point of reference or create the framework for this. And we've touched on this before, and this is just a reminder. One single good decision that becomes automatic. You set it up where there's an automatic withdrawal from your checking account each month to your retirement fund. One decision, one time. A couple of examples of cognitive biases. And I'm just giving you these more common ones to begin to think about and listen for the kinds of things that are not going to be conscious with your clients or as in your own money story. One is a cognitive bias is diagnosis bias. Once we label a person or situation, we then seek data to confirm more vigorously and couple that with blindness to evidence that contradicts. Here's an example of that. A couple of economists, Barry Stahl and Ha Huang, studied skill categories and stats of new NBA players. They distilled the stats into distinct skill measuring categories, scoring, quickness, toughness, and they looked at all the variables that would determine playing time in games for the first 5 years, skill categories, performance, trade status, injury status. There was one variable for the first 5 years that they studied of someone's entry into the NBA that had more impact than any other performance data. It was the player's draft selection choice. In fact, draft order was more highly correlated with playing time through the first 5 years than any other single variable. Now, even though skill and performance determines a draft order, once picked, coaches and managers should be only interested in various categories of performance. Once the draft is over, the draft number should be history and performance is everything. Well, not so, says diagnosis bias. Here are some social biases. Affinity bias. We underestimate the risk of the things we like. We overestimate the risk of things we don't like foreign enemies or an out-of-favor investment. Let's say you lose $20 betting a favorite in the Super Bowl. Well, that's unlucky. But you lose $500 betting that your alma mater would win their big college game, even though they have the worst record in the conference. That's affinity bias. Another, loss aversion. Selling a loser admits defeat. We tend to avoid pain. There's about twice as much bad feeling associated with losing $100 as there is good feeling in gaining $100. And that's been measured. And that's some of the basics of what we've come to learn in behavioral economics. Now, let's look in some practical ways at the most frequent mistakes made in writing a new money story. One, not knowing that you don't know. How can people know they don't know something? We believe we know, which blinds us to our ignorance. This, in turn, causes us to be blind to signs that we may be mistaken. To know to ask is half the answer. To keep an inquisitive, open mind is a beginning. What are other ways to think about this? Are there other possibilities? What am I not seeing? And to someone who is a mentor coach or someone who is a consultant, what are other possibilities I'm not thinking of? Two, stopping at the first right answer. When we're solving problems or writing a new story, we may stop at the first reasonable action. Now, this can be a correct strategy, but it also can stop us from considering other right answers, other correct strategies that could be even more effective. So, ask yourself, and then what? What else? I'm going to introduce number three with a very brief quiz. A couple of you have heard this before. Five frogs sat on a log. They all considered their options. Four, though, planned their strategy and then decided they would jump off. How many were left? Well, five were left because they only planned and decided. They didn't commit to act. Number three is procrastination. Now, I'm talking about some of the broad themes here, the big patterns. Putting off an exercise program, not paying yourself first, not saving for emergencies, not saving for retirement, taking care of others but not yourself. Most of us live our lives as though there were an unlimited amount of time left. We have little sense of urgency that can contribute to a lack of focus. Yeah, we know about lifespan and death. Those are abstractions. When the two-minute warning sounds in football, a team sometimes achieves more in the final 2 minutes than they did in the previous 28. Not the Houston Texans, by the way. This immediate an imminent deadline, a limited, finite amount of time to accomplish goals, focuses attention and concentration and increases efforts. Now, in our lives, we only rarely have a two-minute warning. We play as if the notion of finite time is only an abstraction, something we acknowledge but seem not to internalize. Life is finite. It's just that the game clock is invisible. Four, inefficient energy management. Managing energy is a key to success. This begins with knowing your strengths and limitations, your biological cycles, when you perform best. So think about and strategize about how to enter and exit various states of mind, which works best for a particular task, and how to sustain that immersion, that performance flow and focus. For instance, writing and editing, two different states of mind, two different parts of the brain, to be done at different times and have those times protected. Cluster activities that require the same state of mind. Identify what enhances your energy, anticipation, creativity, pleasure, meditation, prayer. Identify also what depletes your energy, toxic people or situations, negative mindset, lack of focus, negative self-talk. 5, ambiguity. If you're unclear about what options are available and don't know what it would be like to pursue them, especially if you haven't done it before, this uncertainty can add to decision paralysis. What looks like resistance for a client may simply be a lack of clarity about specifically what the next step is. People are more likely to change when new behavior is crystal clear, not vague or absent. Remember, we've talked a number of times, if you want to change, create a habit, change an old habit, focus on the system, because the system is the map. Eat a healthier diet is vague and abstract. The possibilities of eat healthier or save for the future are limitless. Where do you begin? That doesn't tell you what the next step is. When you want to affect change, focus on the system. Script specific behaviors create a map, a behavior map. 6, too many choices. At some point, choices, when they're too much or too many, can debilitate rather than liberate, and someone retreats to the default mode of not making a choice. A classic study that began the whole exploration of decision paralysis was done at a gourmet grocery store. The research project offered a display of 6 jams for tasting. On an alternate weekend, there were 24 jams available for tasting. Both of these weekends, customers were given a coupon for $1 off if they purchased any jam. While the larger display of jams, the 24, attracted more potential customers, when 24 varieties were available for tasting, 3% of people purchased. When only 6 varieties were available for tasting, 30% purchased jams. Too many choices resulted in a tenfold decline of actual purchases. With too many choices, we feel overwhelmed and resort to our comfort zone. We do nothing. I remember going to the academic center in the evening in college, getting all set up in my booth and looking at the vast amount of stuff I did and promptly take a nap. 7, lack of persistence. The truly challenging, courageous part of change is not the initial decision or the initiation of a new order of things. It's the willingness to stay the course, to have a system and stick to it. A clearly defined goal can capture imagination and inspire passion. It can cut through the fog like a beacon in the night. One extra degree of effort in business and in life can separate the good from the great. 51 publishers turned down Richard Bach to publish Jonathan Livingston Seagull. He took it to number 52. 141 publishers turned down a guy who then decided to publish his book himself and sell it out of the back of his car. It had a really unlikely title for a book, Chicken Soup for the Soul. To get what you've never had, you'll probably have to do what you've never done. Lord Eliot put this in a very succinct way. Perseverance is not a long race. It's many short races, one after another. Success is never final. Don't get complacent. Testing is as important as postulating. Test ideas out. Revise them. Make it your story told with your voice. Ross Perot put it this way. Most people give up when they're about to achieve success. They quit on the one-yard line. 8, not following success trails. Have you ever heard or even said some version of these? I want to change careers, but I'm not sure what I do instead. I want to play a bigger game, but I'm not quite sure what that is. I want to create wealth, but I don't exactly have a plan. So first, and a footnote here, the lottery is not a plan. First, decide how you want to expand. Then pick success trails to follow. Watch someone who's doing what you might want to do. Ask if you can take them to lunch or pick their brain or shadow them for a day to observe, but then make it your story. Or do research in a broader number of ways. Let me give you an example. When my really good buddy, Art, heard that I was transitioning from psychoanalytic practice and had completed my professional coach training, he flew to Houston to take me to dinner. A very few years earlier, he left IBM as a senior executive, lead healthcare industry person in the country to start his own corporation. He told me how he chose 5 very successful people in different parts of North America and asked them to lunch, or he flew to their places, asked them to lunch or dinner to pick their brains about what he was about to do. He advised me to do the same, and he let me count him for the first. It worked for both of us. Some business people with instant global recognition pick his brain still for substantial picking fees. So create a support team, maybe an advisory board, a networking group. Engage a mentor coach. Maybe join a mastermind group. 9, believing it's unspiritual to make significant money. There does not have to be a split between spirituality and money. Spirituality and profitability can be quite compatible. There is nothing intrinsically unspiritual about money. It's like one of those assumptions, like starving artists. Why should someone of exceptional talent have difficulty converting that ability into significant income? That's exactly why they need you. Abundance, wealth, spirituality are synonyms. The antonyms, suffering, scarcity, non-spiritual. Now, remember, wealthy does not automatically equate with worldly riches. Rich and spiritual are synonyms. When someone says, I'm not in it for the money, I really believe that person because I know the experience, unless it's a rationalization for not making more money. When you're truly immersed, passionate, delivering immense value, this is synonymous with abundant income. It's the result when there's an alignment. Having a fantastic experience of bringing value to people and making money can be seamlessly interwoven in a spiritual path. You will improve your health by creating less stress, as stress causes the body to be less healthy, as you know. You will create an attitude and an experience of abundance, which will also enhance wellness. And since a state of mind is the most rapidly and fluidly contagious thing in the world, you will attract people also like yourself and help them to achieve in remarkable ways. So there is some information. I'm not going to go into this in detail, but there's information in the workbook about visualization and affirmations. Visualizations are simply ways of creating a future memory, ways to reprogram, rewire your brain by creating a vision, repeating it, and affirmations revise the software, the story to support the vision. And both of those together can be really, really important. And when you program your system with a visualized goal, you create structural tension in your brain, cognitive dissonance. It's the difference between where you are and where you visualize and affirm. When you visualize a successful attainment, your brain then strives to end this tension by actualizing the goal. And again, affirmations provide the story to support your vision. So this structural tension by visualization and affirmation will give you creative ideas, help you see things you haven't seen before. You code your radar, your brain, to perceive certain things that are consistent with your success story. For example, if you see yourself in a successful business, you create the specific imagery to live that experience and then incorporate it as part of your identity rather than it belonging to someone else. Now, the key elements here are repetition, where the neural networks dedicated to your vision must be renewed and repeated regularly or they'll be eliminated. Be very specific about the experience of having achieved the goal and consciously incorporate this new vision into an ongoing story to be ultimately metabolized as part of the self. Otherwise, you'll lose the vision. Now, this is part of the final step, programming new identity. The most powerful force of the human psyche is our identity. That is hardwired as the bedrock of how and who we are, the models that we use to operate on. Think about how important it is to help your client to move the change and transformation that they're experiencing into a part of their identity, into the operating model of how and who they are. Not just something they're doing, but how and who they are in a revised and ongoing way. Because if they don't change their identity, the behavior that they engage will simply revert back to the default mode. So this is something that we do continuously with a client to highlight recognizing and incorporating what they're doing as part of their new story of how and who they are now. This is the validation that becomes internalized. This self-reflection and validation is part of a growth mindset that someone incorporates as part of the work with you that will be the legacy of your coaching experience with them. They will continue this self-reflection, the looking at and examining themselves, and going through the change and transformation to see how they're incorporating what they're learning and doing to evolve in their own growth, in their own potential and capacity. So this is, I think, a really important aspect of what you'll be doing with your clients is to help them internalize the process. And this is the end in mind in the beginning. When a client is doing this autonomously, they don't need us anymore. Now, we may still want to check in. They may want to check in with us because there doesn't have to be a problem or a big challenge to check in. It can simply be a validation and affirmation and a witnessing of progress and celebration of that so that you have an ongoing contact periodically, maybe once a year, maybe once a quarter, with your client to look at and celebrate growth and ongoing aspects and then look at any snags that there may be. So, an overview of these seven steps. We've looked at and illuminated change and transformation in a money story. To recognize authorship, own your story, assess the plot and storylines, decide what to change, map changes, author new experiences, and program new identity. We've looked at your story as looking at money as reality and metaphor, the path as well as the possession, and the power we give it and its own power. In these seven steps, we've articulated some of the secret language of money, how some money issues are really about money, a very few often, and how a bunch of other things hitchhike on money, and how our money stories are a large part of our life stories. These basic steps deconstruct how you write your money story and live it. They're building blocks to revise a money story or write a new one. And these same steps can be used for any other story, but I'd suggest doing one at a time. So, to engineer effectiveness, let's review some essentials of engineering an effective money story, some aspects of the system created. One, make changes tangible and concrete. Construct a yardstick or a map to determine where you are and where you're going, to be able to measure progress along the way, and that also tells you what's detour and distinction and distraction. When you have a map, look at all the stuff you don't have to pay attention to. Everything else in the world except for where you're going. Same with a focus. When you're focused on something and attend to it, millions of other stimuli don't even get engaged. Two, make progress measurable. A specific destination, a tangible focus on the next step. Three, make progress visible. Small, specific, attainable milestones that are visible. And celebration of each small victory. Four, specify the next step. Not abstract, not global. Some's not a number. Soon's not a time. Act healthier is not a strategy. All you ever have to do is the next right thing. This shrinks the change to an immediate step of effectiveness and the experience of momentum and mastery. One of the best examples of shrinking a task to a tangible next step is Alcoholics Anonymous, challenging its members to one day at a time, some even 1 hour at a time. It shrinks the change to a manageable, foreseeable, specific action. A small target leads to small victories, the cumulative experience of effectiveness and mastery. So, what we've done now is we've just adopted the scientific method to examine, to measure, to test, to consider change. The scientific method is a challenge to create a mindset of inquiry itself can generate discomfort, but it also catalyzes growth. Brain imaging studies have demonstrated where the self resides in the brain, the medial prefrontal cortex. This part of the brain lights up when people self-reflect and make assessment and judgments regarding themselves. This is the brain location of identity. This is why identity is a brain reality and why we have to have a systematic way to revise the story that includes the bedrock of our identity. That's what we're doing in these seven steps. A recent study found something that's an important aspect of this. The more clearly and fully you can picture your future self, the more money you save for the future. Emily Pronin at Princeton found that people who can actually have a picture of themselves at 70 to 80, save about 3 times as much through their late 30s through their 50s as people who can't picture their future selves. Now, there's some interesting research that is showing that with age progression, computer-assisted age progression, this same thing can make it more tangible, realistic, more visual for people to see what they look like at this later age. And they're finding the same things. They save about three times as much. For people when they do age, for people who are smokers, for example, they do age progression to show what it's like if they continue smoking versus not. Dramatic stuff. For people who continue to gain 1 pound a year, an age progression to show what that's going to look like in 30 years. This makes it vivid, real, visual. So think about it. The more you identify with your future self, the more decisions you're going to make that are beneficial, from financial to wellness, relationship even. So a review of some guidelines. Listen for the story that the source within you tells. Don't ignore it. Don't try to override it or superimpose something else. Listen. Listen for your wise self. Tell your story the way you want it to be in order to actualize it, to plan it, map it, and tell it to initiate its creation. There, I've done a number of essays for coaches who have done wellness and financial coaching training with me and use that for continuing education white papers. Those are compiled in a book that was published recently called Engaging the Ineffable Toward Mindfulness and Meaning. There are 21 different topics, and I've covered a heads up for some. One is nostalgia. Another is self. There are a number of things that have to do with coaches that I've kind of pulled from or illustrated in our discussion, and especially in the summary. So whatever you're living or experiencing in any way is in response to the story you're telling. If you want the story to change, you have to change the way you tell the stories so that it shifts your feeling and thinking as you are telling it. This means that responses from others are not in the creation of equation. At least the point of reference for you and your story is you. This new telling has to be in alignment with who you are, especially with your needs and ideals, in order to have a complete energy field and full purposeful direction going forward. When you practice the story that resonates with who you really are, your full energy and power become activated. All of you is going in the same direction. When that occurs, know the direction you're going and the goal and strategies of that pathway. Know that you can keep telling and living a better story no matter how good your story is now. The universe will resonate with and match your story as you live it. Now, here's a final story and then a final quote. The final story. For tens of thousands of years before books and computers, we transmitted our essence and our principles by story. Story linked to the past, organized the present, and illuminated the future. Story allowed us to connect with each other's humanity in the paths crossed on the long journeys out of Africa to populate the rest of the world. Then the anatomy and physiology of our brains grew by putting thoughts and feelings into stories. Stories informed, instructed, inspired, governed, organized. Story is the most powerful way humans communicate. Stories give birth to possibilities. Stories are a way that we resonate with our earlier selves, connect with others, and create a roadmap to proceed. Your story is yourself, your life, and what will survive you. At some point in the distant future, all that will be left of you, all that will survive you, is your story. Be sure to get it right. Now, a final quote. And this is a three-paragraph quote. This may be the turning point your grandchildren will tell stories about years from now. The time you leap over the abyss to the other side of the great divide and begin your life in earnest. On the other hand, this moment of truth may end up being nothing more than a brief awakening when you glimpse what's possible on the other side of the great divide, but tell yourself, nah, it's way too far to jump. In that case, your grandchildren will have to be content talking about what delicious cookies you used to bake or what your favorite sports team was. It will all depend on how brave you'll be. Okay, we're in discussion mode now. I'm eager to hear thoughts, questions, things that you'd like to talk more about, challenges with your clients. Let me ask you the question first. What's the most common money mistake that we made? Now, you've heard all this, and you've heard ideas, but what do you think the most common money mistake that we make is? Anybody? Any guesses?
Hi, Dave. This is Janina.
Hey, how are you? Take a chance. Go ahead. What you got?
I'm thinking not knowing where their money is going and how much they're spending.
Okay. I think that's powerful, yeah. And that's going to relate to how I'm going to say it. So I think you're right, basically. Other guesses or other thoughts about this? Well, think about the most common money mistake that we make is opportunity cost. Opportunity costs are the things that we lose, that we give away now or later in order to do something now. In other words, the opportunities that we sacrifice when we make a choice. What this means is that when we spend money on one thing, we can't spend it on something else. A really simple example. You've got $1, and you're in front of a choice of an apple for $1 or an orange for $1. The opportunity is to buy one. The opportunity cost is that you won't be able to have the other. We give up an opportunity that dollars can provide now or in the future when we make a choice to spend on a specific item now. Let's broaden that a little bit. Let's say you have $500 each week. Beginning on Monday, that's all you can spend. No going into debt, no other income, no borrowing, begging, $500. In the beginning of the week, you may not really consider what you're giving up later in the week when you have dinner and a drink. And then you buy an expensive shirt. Well, by Friday, you're looking at the whole weekend ahead. You've got $42 left. The tough choice left on Sunday is you can either buy a newspaper or a bagel with the remaining money and to remember the dinner, drink, and the shirt on Monday. On Monday, there was an opportunity cost to consider, but it wasn't clear. It wasn't specific and thought out. It wasn't in the foreground of thought of conscious choice or decision. Sunday, though, the opportunity cost is finally clear, but it's too late. And the reason that this may be the biggest money mistake, we usually don't think about it as conscious choice. We don't consider our money as a closed system, a finite resource where one choice affects another. And, of course, opportunity costs are not restricted only to money, but that's a whole other decision. So good guesses and thanks. Other things, what else would you like to discuss other challenges with clients, questions about the material, what would be most helpful?
David, this is Janina again, if it's okay.
Yeah, please, go ahead.
Regarding affirmations, the affirmations that we tell ourselves, are we supposed to believe them right away, or is it something that we grow to believe?
It's something that you believe as you say it, even though you're knowing that you're living into it. You know, and look at some of the examples in the material. Let's say you have a vision of success, and the affirmations need to involve, the visualization needs to involve all of your senses. The full experience of achieving the success, because you're etching this visualization. The entire visual. I didn't mention a story when I did a presentation to a group of executives who wanted to talk about doing a first book. There were 24 executives present, and we did like a 3-hour workshop. The very first question I asked them when I got to the podium. How many of you in the last month have seen a yellow Jeep? And they kind of looked around. They realized I was serious. One person out of 24 raised his hand. I then did an exercise with them to visualize a yellow Jeep. Some of you have done training with me have done this before, where you get grounded and centered. And we go through the entire visualization, all the sensory experience, the various senses. When I asked them then, after doing this visualization, if they happened to see a yellow Jeep in the next week, would they contact me? In the first 3 days, 22 of the 24 people contacted me to say they'd seen a yellow Jeep. Now, this created a future memory. It coded their radar for a yellow Jeep. Now, when you do a visualization of successfully attaining something, the affirmations would be things, the story that supports the visualization. So, as I achieve this, I am going to find the ways to enjoy and affirm this. I'm going to create benefit for a number of people. This is going to be an empowering experience that I'll feel positive about. So the affirmations are the true support of the visualization is rewiring your brain. The affirmations are for revising your software. And think about the benefit of positive self-talk. Because negative self-talk creates a whole mindset that will follow the negative self-talk with experience. When you create affirmations, you're creating a positive mindset to live into. Let me give you just a simple example. I know some of you have heard this before. We've touched on this, so I'm not going to review it now. But does this make sense to you about your question about the affirmations?
Absolutely. Yes.
Okay. All right. Great. Yeah. Good question, and a real practical one for creating something like that. Other thoughts, questions, things that might be helpful to talk about or apply with clients. Have you begun to think about or apply anything that we've talked about with any of your clients at this point? Let me ask a different question then. From what we've talked about in these four seminars, to you, what was the single most important thing that you're taking away from our discussions? the one thing that has had an impact.
Hey, Dave, it's Eric. I would
say
very powerful is the very notion that a story can be rewritten. That was the, you know, that was something that, you know, that's almost a future memory being written, because I knew that going in. But as we've gone through the process, that has been something that has just been so powerful to me, that we have the power to rewrite these, rewrite our past and write our own future.
Absolutely, and thank you for that. And as we're thinking about it and discussing it, even though it just seems automatic and seems the way things are, it's not there until we create it. It may be etched as an algorithm in our brain, but when we activate it and create something, we're creating it this moment. And every day is a blank page, whatever we think and feel and experience of what we create each moment. So one of the first things to recognize is what we are automatically creating, to recognize and own and assess that, to decide what we want to change, but then to go beyond that, to look at what we can create, what we would like to, and then to plan in a systematic way to do that. So it's both and more in a way. So that's, yeah, thank you. That's good. I'm glad that it came across so vividly like that, and you put it in a very simple and elegant way. And that's one of the challenges that we have in coaches, is to be very clear, brief, and simple as we're relating to our clients, so that they don't have to use cognitive energy to figure out what we're saying or to keep up with a long, convoluted question, said the guy whose sentences average 274 words, as he encourages you to make a question to a client of 10 words or less. So other single thing, and that we just touched on that. That comes from some neuroscience studies that we attend to and retain up to 10 words at a time. So it's important that we speak clearly, briefly, and simply, and how much more powerful that will be. Anyone else? The single most important thing, or the most impactful thing that you've that you're taking away from this?
Hi, Dave. This is Janina again.
Please.
I just want to say how much I enjoyed the workbook. Exercises were really great. I really like the roadmap. It really gives you a clear step-by-step process of how to actually do the change and change your story. I really enjoyed the workbook. It was very, very good.
Good. I'm glad it was helpful. Thank you. Good.
Yes. And also, if I may ask you, where can we buy the book that you mentioned in this class, Engaging the Inevitable? I only caught the first few words.
Oh, okay. I think it's on my signature line of the email I sent a day or two ago. But they're on Amazon, Engaging the Inevitable. And you'll see it on, but it's in my last email.
Okay, perfect.
Below my name. I'm pretty sure it's there.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other thoughts, questions, things that might be helpful or even challenges with clients?
Well, Dave, I'll just share the one, there are many, but I really resonated with the thought of, it's still the whole idea that you've conceptualized in many ways, but show me an obstacle and I'll show you a desire, and the whole idea to, rather than defeat the obstacle, really generate or create something else instead. And with money being energy and an expression in many forms, I think there's so much that can be applied there. So that's a key takeaway for me.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much. It would have taken me 5 minutes to say what you just summarized. Yeah, that's great. Yeah. Yeah, thanks. That's a great reflection. I'm glad that was helpful. Yeah, some of the work is to get to a position of simplicity, and only then can we recognize how much complexity that we've attached to something. So that's a part of an ongoing work for us first, and then to help our clients recognize a position of simplicity, to look at the elements and how they can then be put together in new and exciting ways. Anything else? Any other questions about coaching and applying this? I assume everyone on the line, I know there's a lot of people who haven't spoken. I'm assuming everyone, or almost all of you at least, are coaches or in some coach training. I hope this has been helpful to you and useful for you in your practices and in helping to. Yes, go ahead.
Hey, Dave, I'm sorry. I got a question for you. This is Eric again.
Yeah.
What's a... never in terms of diagnosis, of course, but, you know, I'm in Laurie Cameron's CTA certification class right now. We're talking a lot about identifying groups, niches, and, you know, figure out who we're going after and who we're really trying to serve. So this money, so the idea of rewriting the money story, who are likely candidates for going through this? Is it someone who has already gotten themselves in trouble or someone who's headed that way? That would be my first question.
Well, I think when you're talking about niche, you're talking about a specific who, and you cannot get too narrow or too well-defined. The coaches I've trained who have had the narrowest and the most specific niche are the people who filled their practices first, simply because that allows you to know where they traffic, where their ecosystems are, where their watering holes are, and especially to know where the gatekeepers, the referral sources are to open referrals to a whole portal of people who you would never have contact with. So the niche may be one aspect, and another aspect may be a specialty, and that's a distinction. The people, many of the people who I train as new money story mentors, for example, they may be outright financial coaches, or they may simply coach aspects of people who are going through divorce or who are retiring from the military or retiring and dealing with aspects of money and finances in a different way, and that's one component of what they do, and that may be an entry into a group of people with that specialty, or it may be something you do as part of another niche, like women going through divorce, or military retirees, or expats. Think about niche as the who, and then the specialty of what you do with that group of people.
Right. So for someone who's coaching business or entrepreneurship, then that's something that, you know, being able to rewrite that story and pre-visualize it could be very powerful.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's
okay,
that,
great.
That's where I began my coaching practice, to help practicing professionals achieve and sustain peak performance. And the lowest hanging fruit is, I think, way better even than a niche, because the lowest hanging fruit are the existing relationships you already have. And those are the most likely people to know you, to refer to you. And those are the people you probably would want to contact first with a letter of announcement about what you're doing in your coaching practice and how to refer to you, and indicating, especially to the referral sources, that you'll give a free sample session to anybody they refer. So, you know, think first about your lowest hanging fruit, and then about developing a niche, because that allows you to really know the challenges of someone who you are going to work with, and how to reach them, how to use, how to have conversations with them. Remember the stick figure that we drew inside the circle. That stick figure is your potential client. From a marketing perspective, we talked about it in terms of coaching, but from a marketing perspective, and that's all niche is. It's just about marketing. You can still coach anybody about anything, but niche helps you to know and to be much more informed from a marketing perspective to let people know about what you do.
Yep. That's great.
It doesn't limit.
Thank you for that.
You see. Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you very much for that. Awesome.
Sure. Any other questions, comments, things that might be helpful to discuss? Well, I appreciate very much all of your energy, the responses that you've sent in terms of the questions, the responses to my initial questions. I will be eager to hear how you find this material as you perhaps use it, incorporate it a bit more. If there's any way that I can be of help to you in any ongoing way, I hope you'll let me know, and I'll be interested to hear what you guys are up to. So thanks very, very much. And it's been a privilege and enjoyable working with you, and I'd love to hear from you. So let's make this to be continued. Thanks very, very much.
That's great.
See you guys now.
Thank you, Dave.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye, everyone.
See you guys.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.
See you.